My name's Dave Doss. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
And let's kick it off again with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, now we are going to do 6, 7, 8, and 9. The direction that I got from my sponsor after I did the fifth step was any time that he put a definite time frame other than now on the steps, and any time I got any break at all was on step 6. And I was at this retreat, and he suggested it after we had got done with the fifth step that I go back to my room and reflect over the first 5 steps and be sure that there wasn't anything that I was holding back. And our book talks about, talks about not skimping, talks about let's not make mortar without sand. Let's be sure that the work that we've done is solid so far, because if it's not, and I certainly have seen people hold on to things in their fifth step who have refused to disclose some of the most difficult things about their life and have gone on to get drunk. I've seen that happen many times, and I did. I went back to my room and I sat quietly for an hour, and I really, there was nothing that I was holding back. I really felt like I had been as honest and thorough as I could possibly be. And in the big book, I always thought 6 and 7 were gravy, because you take this hour, and 6 is nothing more than having, and one thing I do want to read 6. We're entirely ready to have God, capital G, remove all these defects of character. I remember, with respect to 6, certainly, that day, I took the hour, and I didn't want to be the person I had seen in that 4th and 5th step. I did not want to be that person. I mean, that's really part of what drove me into Alcoholics Anonymous, is just being horrified at who I had become. And I got on my knees, and I said the 7th step prayer, and I asked God to change me. I really did. I asked Him to take away those difficulties. I thought that was it. I thought, well, I've done 6 and 7, and now I'm on 8. Wow, that was easy. And what I found out is that 6 and 7 kind of continue to crop up in my life. And especially, Tom likes to tell a story, and I'll tell it like it's mine, since it probably stole it from somebody anyway, He talks about sitting down with his sponsor and we're talking about working on his character defects. Because it sounds very industrious in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm working on my character defects. It sounds very industrious. And he talks about sitting down with his sponsor and telling him that he was, working on his character defects. And his sponsor asked him to read the 6th step to him. We're entirely ready to have God remove, he said, slower. We're entirely ready to have God, he said, slower. Now, Tom's sponsor, Wally, and I've met Wally. Wally really does exist, by the way. And I don't know whether it's sort of like a father thing. Like my grandfather, my mother tells me that my grandfather was much harder on her than he ever was on the grandchildren. And somehow they sort of mellowed, with age. And I wonder that about Wally, because Wally doesn't seem to be anywhere near as hard as Tom, painted him to be. He just seems to be this nice, gentle old guy to me, Matter of fact, I couldn't believe it. Tom, like, first time I met Wally, I was like, Tom, I can't believe that's your sponsor. He's so humble. All right, I'll stop now. I know you get it after me. Yeah, it's true. And so Wally's a little hard of hearing, as Tom said. And so, in the story, Tom says, Wally asked him to repeat himself again. And he said, we're entirely ready to have God. And Wally says, who is God? He says, well, what are you doing working on your character defects then? This is God's job to change us. Much as I am powerless over my alcoholism, I am truly, for the most part, powerless over my character defects, and that's not an excuse. I don't mean to say that I go out and behave poorly and then justify it by saying I'm sick. That's why I do these things, because I don't believe that. But I do believe what I read one time in an abnormal psychology book in a college course that I took while I was still drinking. And in that abnormal psychology book, it basically, the gist of what I had read in the chapter was that we are unable to change our personality. That we are unable, once it's pretty much established, to change who and what we are. And it is very, very difficult to do that. And that's sort of what the big book alludes to in the spiritual appendix. Is that, you know, what years of self-discipline, what years of work could not accomplish can often be accomplished in a few short months with God's help. That of myself and by myself, I am largely incapable of changing me. Not just my alcoholism, but the reflection of my alcoholism is really my character defects. You know, especially once I stop drinking, right? I mean, that's, you know, I'm no longer drinking, so the reflection of my alcoholism is my character defects, not alcohol anymore. And that's really where I believe, you know, God has to intervene in my sobriety. Because otherwise, after a period of time, I will go back to drinking because I cannot stand my defective character. And so in 6 and 7, what at first appeared to be a very simple thing, and moving very quickly through them 1 to 8, over time and continuing to take that inventory, and whether you say that you go through 4 through 9 on a regular basis or you do a true 10th step, is, to me, it's immaterial. It's the same thing. You're continuing to take inventory. There have been issues in my life. There have been character defects. Right around 10 years of sobriety, there were some character defects that were just eating my lunch. You know, I had resentments come back. I had ego come back. I had greed come back. I had lust come back in a way that I knew was threatening my life. And I sat down and wrote another inventory and went over with my sponsor because, you know, although a lot of the stuff had been removed, although a lot of the wreckage had been cleared, that I could see that there were still areas which were glaring. And if something wasn't done about them, that they would go on to wreck my life. And I don't want to pay the price anymore. I don't like living with that wreckage. And there is certainly in 6 and 7. The other thing too is that I had, you know, in hindsight, you know, with 3 months of sobriety, I had so little awareness of what was really wrong with me. And I really do believe in the analogy of the onion as you peel away the layers. And I really do believe in Alcoholics Anonymous that in some ways the road does get narrower as time goes on, because the standard that I'm held to, and I'm not talking about what you hold me to, the standard that I hold me to, is based on the joy of living. And what happens is over time, I don't suffer well, and over time, I have become very accustomed to feeling good. And when I stray slightly from that path, the cost is my peace and my serenity, and I don't suffer well. So in some ways, the road has become narrower, not because of some standard put on me by outside, but because of an internal standard and because of you all have given me such a good life. And so trying to stick to that still requires constant effort, and really, really more than the 11th step in prayer and meditation and asking God and continue to take that inventory. 8 and 9 is really the core of the amend steps. I went to my sponsor with a list in 8, and I really recommend that certainly you don't start making amends until you go over the list with your sponsor. It's a very valuable filter for who needs to have the amends made and how. You know, sometimes it's hard. Hard for us. I had a sponsee recently who made an amend to someone who actually did more damage than they would have had they left them alone. In order to get peace of mind for themselves. And even though I had advised him not to make that and we had talked about how to make it, he had sort of gone on his own and did it and actually wound up by hurting the person more because he wanted to be free of something. And the rule is, and I really do believe it, the rule is that we be hard on ourselves and easy on others. You know, that we really have to have a sponsor, and I think we have to have an objective opinion on who's on that list, why they're on the list, and what we're going to say to them when we see them. And I really do believe in face-to-face amends. I didn't harm people by mail. I didn't harm people by phone. You know, I really do believe in face-to-face amends. And any exception that I've heard to that is, and my wife who uses this example, is she had had an ex-boyfriend who was very violent and didn't want to make the amends face-to-face. fear of safety. And I think that's legitimate in those kind of cases. But that's the only case that I've really heard of. I don't have any in my story. I believe you harm them face-to-face, you make amends to them face-to-face. And I'll share with you the list. I had a list of, and you know what's surprising to me? By the time I got to the eighth step, is the list was not all that long. You know, I really would have liked to have told you that the list was, you know, was super long. But it really wasn't. And the people that were on the list, for the most part, were the people that were closest to me. You know, I really do believe in, you know, when it talks in the book about us coming out of the slight linen cellar and looking around and saying, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing, you know? And that's sort of, I mean, that's sort of where I was, you know, at 6 and 7. Wow, man, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing. And then we started looking at 8 and the wreckage around. And the wreckage was evident not only in my life, but in the eyes of my family who, you know, for a long, long time wasn't sure whether or not I would stay. Wasn't sure whether or not when I would walk in the door whether I'd be drunk or sober. And wasn't sure for a long time whether or not they could trust me with money or believe a word I said. You know, it took some time. It takes time to do the damage, and it takes time to try to set it right. And in some cases, a guy that I admired and respected, and a guy named Frank Lynch, who's been dead a while now, and I knew his wife June well, you know, Frank tells a story where you know, he was sober 35 years, and his daughter still would not see him or permit him to see his grandchildren. And he never did get that wish. The wreckage that he had done through his alcoholism, you know, had driven her away to the point that she would not allow him back in her life. Even with 30, 40 years of sobriety, you know, he never got to see his grandchildren again. Sometimes we don't get back what we've lost. You know, and that's not really what this is about, as I see it. What it's really about is learning how to live what we've got left, and a whole new life. You know, often we might not get back what we've lost, but I do believe, and in my life, that I've seen God put things in there that I never would have seen coming, that fill my life and make it richer. One of the things my sponsor did, I had this list of people, mostly my family, a few ex-girlfriends who he promptly crossed off. I really wanted to make amends to them bad, you know. I was single at the time, and, you know, I was hoping they were too, you know. Now he took off some of them, but he left one or two on there that really were legitimate. And then he took out his little pen, and there are some people who have some issue with what I'm going to say, but I don't really care. I had this list 1 to 10 or 15, whatever it was, and he took out his pen, he put a 1A, and he put Dave. Put me at the head of the list. Now there are some people who say, well, no, you don't need to make amends yourself. What kind of selfish crap is that? You know who I'm still hardest on today? You know who the person I have the hardest time forgiving, the person I hold the resentments the longest against, and the person that I often dislike the most? Me. I hold myself to a standard much higher than I hold you to. It's a form of ego, by the way, in case you're wondering. I didn't know that until my sponsor told me that. That, you know, often I judge myself by a different standard because I believe that I'm different and better. You know? And so that's a form of ego, but still today, and in my experience has been that I think alcoholics have a really hard time forgiving ourselves and getting past the internal damage that we do. And that really the only way to do that and amend to myself is continue to walk down this path. That has been the only way that, you know, I've talked a little bit about the internal, the self-esteem and the character building and the, you know, and how do you recover that? And it's from the outside in, and that's what I really believe. And by doing the things that I find here, I do make amends to myself. And I'm changed. And over time, even though I'm very hard on myself, I can't deny that you all and God have changed me. And it's not me. You know, you all and God have done it. And I, you know, I can't deny. I watch it happen to you day in and day out. And, you know, I watch you change. And so I know I'm in the right place. I know I'm doing the right things. And the other thing is, Tom, I got out of the format here. I went like 6, 7, and 8. So, well, I'm going to give it to you and let you do whatever you want to do with it now. And then we'll come back to 9.
Sounds reasonable to me. When you're in recovery, recovery sounds reasonable to you. If you're righteous, nothing but your own way seems reasonable to you. So I'm wrongious.
Yeah.
That's a new word, wrongious. That's the opposite of righteous. So we get to step 6 with the Zen truck driver. And he is a Zen truck driver. David calls away, you say. what he is. And he's a very kind Zen truck driver, but he's consistent. Very consistent. Now, I told him I was working on myself, like Dave said. I wanted to be industrious. I wanted to impress him how serious I was taking this program. I wanted his endorsement, the pat on the head or back or kick in the ass or something. I don't know. You know, I'm doing this stuff. And he says to me, not only does he say to me that I can't fix myself. Who's in charge? I says, God. He says, what do you got your fingers in there for? He says, don't you know a sick mind cannot fix a sick mind? You appeal to God. God's got a healthy mind. He will fix a sick mind. Oh. Now, being fresh off of the fifth and fourth step, I had some real good reasons to have these defects removed, because it was fresh in my mind that the barriers to joyful living were the defects that my sponsor had just pointed out to me. It was fresh in my mind what a part fear played in my life. And what the opposite of fear was trust. And what a part ego had played in my life. See? What a part self-centeredness had played in my life. And the answer was God-centeredness. And I couldn't get from self-centeredness to God-centeredness, the answer, by my own mind. I could only get the self-centeredness, I mean the God-centeredness, the answer from the problem, Tom-centeredness, through the rest of the steps, the guidance of a sponsor, and working with others. Absolutely required, not suggested, required. Bill's in the Mayflower Hotel. He is in deep doo-doo. His business trip went down the drains. He is short on bucks. He's a little lonesome for Lois. And he calls to bitch to her. And he complains to all these guys I work with, and they all got drunk. And she says to Bill, but you stayed sober, and triggered a thought. And Bill called Tonks looking for someone to work with. Dr. Bob did not call Bill. Bill had to find someone to work with. And this starts in the sixth step. The problem is Tom. The answer is outside of Tom. Tom, with a problem mind and a sick mind, even knowing the solution, still is powerless. We're back to powerless again, Dave. Powerless to bring about what he knows. So he appeals to God, so it says, was entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Not Tom. Tom prayed to have or worked to get sober, right? Worked on himself to get sober. He got drunk. Tom worked on himself in his marriage, and he got divorced. Tom worked on his job or career, and he got fired. Tom worked on understanding things, and he wound up in a nut house. I didn't have no lock on my side of the door, you know. There was not an architectural oversight. I was nuts. I mean, they didn't even touch on a child within. He skipped all that crap. You're nuts. That's deflation of ego in depth. That's what they mean. They're nuts. I knew it. It was a very relaxing thing to know I was nuts. I no longer had to pretend to know anything. I sit next to a window. Where's the window? I don't know. I'm not an engineer. Very relaxing. So we get to seven now. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? How many of us here? It's really the way I feel and the way I believe. I don't think I should hold anything back with people I love. With people I know love me. How often do you hear this garbage? I just want to become a better person. But join the church, for God's sake. They'll give you all the betterment you can stand. You may become a better person if you experience the steps in your life, if you're an alcoholic. But that will be a byproduct of the spiritual awakening. It is not the end in itself. The big book is explicit on that. We are trying to put our lives in order. That's what it says, doesn't it? But that is not an end in itself. Our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people around us. And that's what the spiritual awakening is all about, to be a maximum service. It's not to become a better person.
Oh, I just want to be a better person.
Nice. It's real Dale Carnegie. You do that kind of shit. You're very popular, better, you know. You'd be one of the people in the back of the church. You're there for a while. You ever see them with the real thin blue lips? They're real tense and very holy and pious. And they're like afraid somewhere out there. There's somebody having fun. And it's their job to stop it because it's got to be sinful. Wait, I don't want that. I don't know what to do about it. Let's say what the big book says about it. They call it the seven-step prayer, which we find appropriately on 7.6. That is page 76. Right? When ready. Now, if you ain't ready, don't say this. Say what you want. I just want to become a better person. I want to do the next right thing. Hey, like that. Hey, that sounds good. That's good sociology. Next right thing. Do you know of an alcoholic that really has a good agenda? I don't know. But if you have a good agenda, you know what's next. But if you're an alcoholic, you really don't know what's next. If you trust, you realize that God knows what's next. But you really don't know what's next. And a lot of times, we can't separate the true from the false, or the right from the wrong. So if you want to do the next right thing, consider the limitations of having a poor agenda and not knowing what's right. But outside of that, you're okay. That stuff creeps into here from Sociology 101. My job is to take it out. Yeah, see, in many groups, they have a GSR, you know, and they got intergroup rep. My group's got a DSB, but that's the only group I know. It's my job to do that. I'm the designated son of a bitch. And my job is to take this stuff out of the group. Every group needs one, you know. And you need a person that don't give a darn about public opinion, realizing that we don't get sober by committee. I realize that. We don't get recovery from the endorsement of others. We get the recovery by the acceptance of a loving God in the exact manner in which he is presented to us. No conditions, no terms. What does the prayer say? My creator. That's where I come from, I guess, huh? He's the creator. I am now willing. I'm out of the in charge business. I am willing. That you should have all of me. Whew, that's an order, ain't it? Poor God. Have all of me. Good and bad. We can't separate, can we? Good and bad. We give it all to him because we can't separate it. We don't know. We like to know what we don't. See? I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character. So I become a better person. No, it don't say that. Every defect of character, right? Which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. That's the reason we have them removed. So we who are unfit can become willing to become made fit to carry this message, the message of recovery through the spiritual awakening to God and our fellows. When they say fellows, I think that's an inclusive thing. It's also your family and so forth. Okay? They're in your life. We carry the message, spiritual awakening. That's what we have to become fit to do. Why? When I am busy working with a new person. I am outside of the troubled or danger zone. Me. I'm outside of me. I'm with you. With Alfred. Not Curtis. I was with Curtis this morning. Outside. So I'm outside the trouble zone. I'm in the answer zone. The God zone. What takes me there? Am I thinking? No. What takes me there? A willingness to help others. One that must watch, I can't do this, Wally. I'm not qualified. You see, you've been sober like 6 months, Tom. Yeah, Wally, I mean, I don't make people. I was afraid. Really, I was copping a plea. Thought you had to be an expert. He says, a new man coming through the door. He's got 6 days sobriety. You got 6 months. Hey, Wally, I'm only got 6 months. I told you. He said, get over there and tell him what you did to get 6 months. Tell him exactly what you did. But for God's sake, don't tell him what you think. That's what he's wrong. So I'm over the door telling him what I did. I was tempted to tell him I would have little flashbacks of intellectual seizure, but I'm down to spasms now. I just quiver a little bit and he leaves. You know what I mean? I don't get caught up in it. See? I'm not telling him what I did or her. It makes no difference. What I did. And I said, this is what happened when I did this. God became closer to me. I became less afraid of God. And my idea that I could offend God started to diminish. As we drew near to him, more was revealed. God's size, power, and love was revealed. And Tom's importance and great sins were diminished. You know, I don't know whether it's a spiritual axiom or not. It's more like putting preparation H on my character defects. It don't cure it, but shrinks it down to where it's manageable. Something rather mundane, you know. But you all know what I mean.
Sure.
Then we come over to 8, right? We're going to write this down, people we had harmed. And like Dave, well, Dave was a little more informed than me. I had a lot of... My sponsor looked at it. He said, who do you think you are? You know, Charlie Manson or something? What the hell is this? It's long, this. He said, you don't have the power to harm all them. You just overestimated your ability to impact the lives of other people. And that's ego. I thought it was a scrupulous conscience. Oh, doesn't that sound good? Oh, he is so scrupulous and narrow. No, he says you got ego. You think that you could impact the lives of other people. You assume that you have more free will than they do. Free will is equally distributed. I can't offend you without your permission. How would I figure I could offend God when I can't even offend Wally without his permission? Uh-oh. I wonder where this is going to take me. Well, I said, I don't care what it takes. You just ask God and get his direction. That was it. We can't impact the lives of people like we think. No, we didn't. Well, they told me. Well, they told you the best they had. But it wasn't enough. They told you, stop drinking, you would be okay. It was the best they had, but it wasn't enough. So scratch them off. You could offend people like children who depended upon you. Yes, you can. They don't have a fully developed will. You can defend if a wife or a husband who is dependent upon you for basic living, you know? Yes, you can offend them. Not greatly, but you can offend them. Okay. So you owe them amends. And make them. What does amends mean? Does it mean, oh, I'm sorry. I went to my ex-wife. I was married for 25 years. She said, yeah, I know you're sorry. I mean, ain't no bullets in there. Had to put her down. Had to go talk to her. That's the nice step. I'll tell you a little bit about that. And one of the great things about the other steps to prepare you for this step is this, that we learn how to listen for the first time in our lives. Isn't that amazing? Now we're going to listen to someone else without thinking of a response while they're talking. What a gift, huh? There's the gift. We can listen. Accidentally, I discovered by going to meetings on a regular basis and doing some step work with people, I have become a trained listener. I did not set out to become a trained listener. And I tell you how I know it. Sometimes I take in my career, require continuing education. A lot of us have to do that. And I could sit in a career class and listen for an hour without jumping up and down and having wires and tapes and all that other outside trappings that people bring, you know, whistles and bells and tapes. I can listen for an hour and go home in about 15 minutes, jot a whole outline down. The whole hour. I couldn't do that before. And the difference between then and now is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a byproduct. Now, I didn't set out to take a memory course. I set out to get sober, and you told me I couldn't stay sober unless I got recovered. And that's what happened. Now we'll go on to the ninth step. I'll just share two instances with you. One is I had to make amends to the ex-wife. And she is a quality woman. She was an informed, loving, considerate woman. She had the misfortune to be married to a fellow like me. She must have been very open-minded because when she's in front of the priest, she said yes. She was open-minded. And after 25 years, we became divorced, and I went, and my sponsor says, you have to make direct amends to her. First of all, he said to me, is she in the continental United States? That's what he wanted to know. I said, yeah. That's all he wanted to know. You got to make direct amends to her. He didn't care if she was in California, but continental, that's all he said. And she was, so I had to go and talk with her, and I listened to her. Stuff that I thought was terrible. She didn't think it was a big deal. But the thing that really struck me, I had a lot of guilt about this drunkenness and stuff that it brought on to me, onto our life. Us, her, too. She was an indirect victim of that. And I really didn't know what to do about it. So my sponsor gave me some directions for some amends to make to her. But I had to go back and talk with her about 5 times. And he says, take her to a public place. You were married to her for 25 years. You ought to know what restaurant she likes. So that's what I did. She thought, and she was pretty much convinced that I wouldn't drink again, and I wasn't. Here's an oddity. The non-alcoholic that I'm making amends to had more confidence in my continued sobriety than I did. I didn't expect that. You know what she was still concerned about? That I wouldn't be faithful to her. That's what she was concerned about. And she expressed it. I asked her to express everything. She did. So on that basis, I believe she had some idea of reconciliation. I didn't know. You know, I didn't have an idea, plus or minus. I just simply didn't know, that's all. And but I thought it best, I asked my sponsor about it, he just said pray about it. But I thought it best for me to continue with the steps and keep my focus on recovery. And wherever that took me, to let it take me. And when it was necessary for a more definite direction to be known to me in God's time and in God's way, it would be known to me. It's that simple. So far, God has not said I should get married. So a lot of women have been protected from any further damage from at least me. I'm sure there's some other guys out there taking up the slack. But I ain't going to be one of them. It's that simple. And the other one was, like Dave, my father died when I was sort of young, and I had to go to work and all. And my youngest brother was like 18 years younger than me. And we ran out of aunts and uncles. There was 9 kids. So I was telling somebody at lunch, I think Nancy, I slept in a bed with 2 other brothers, you know, and I always slept in the middle. I'm the only brother that ever fell out of bed. You know? So that's why I stay in AA. I stay right in the middle. I'm the leader in AA, and I don't come down at the end of the meeting. I'm in the middle somewhere, and I haven't fallen out of AA either. So anyway, he had left Maryland when he was 17 and a half or 18, very angry. Now he was supported pretty good. He went to a private, a Jesuit high school and a college. Opportunity was made available to him. He didn't want it. And in the middle of the Vietnamese War, he joined the Army, and he was very angry. And he never wanted to come back to Maryland again. And for, let's see, he was about 50, so about 32 years he didn't. And in those 30-some years, I carried a heavy heart because I knew I took care of his physical wants and that stuff. But I thought I ignored his emotional growth or anything like that because I was out there busy making money. Money was important to me. It would fix everything, I thought. So I carried a lot of guilt about that. That's the reason he doesn't want to come back. I didn't know for sure, but that's what I figured. So he had a girlfriend down in Daytona Beach who called one of my other brothers and said, your brother's dying from cancer, the youngest one. He was about 50 or 52. So I went down to see him because my sponsor says you got to go down and see him in person. Make your amends if you think you've done this, and make your amends. So I did a very thorough thing because I'm sober a few years, you know. I know about all this stuff. I'm doing a very thorough mindset. Flying down there, get off the plane. His girlfriend picks me up and takes him over. He was glad to see me. I'm all defensive. He's glad to see me. So I start talking to him. He says to me, Tom, I know what you're doing. I said, what do you mean, Pat? You know what I'm doing. He says, for God's sake, I've been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years. It's a nice step. I had to do it too. Oh, shit. Got to want the list. I said, this is what I thought happened. He says, no, you got it wrong. Got it wrong. I said, how did I get it wrong? I neglected you. He said, I remember you taking me to the Colts games when they played in Baltimore. I remember you introducing me to Raymond Berry. I knew Raymond Berry. I remember you took me up. Brooks Robinson was a friend of mine. I introduced you to Brooks Robinson. You know, when he was a little kid, and he remembers that. Let me tell you something about alcoholics in the ninth step. Right now. You are not qualified to judge you no more than I was, and I carried that shit for 32 years. And it wasn't until I followed your directions, doing the nice stuff, like it is in here, at the direction of a sponsor, that I found out I was wrong. I was wrong. Then I said to myself, how many other things you think you're wrong about, Tom? Similar in nature. Similar in nature. You ain't qualified to judge you. You ain't qualified to judge nothing. The only thing you're qualified to do is have an opinion about stuff. But it's not a matter of right or wrong. You just have an opinion. Some stuff your opinion is more informed, and on other stuff it's less informed. And God's other kids, the best they could have is an opinion too. So don't get in an argument with them about anything. Their opinion next week will change. And if you're growing, hopefully yours will too, because that's life. It's the continuality of change. The only people who don't change are in cemeteries. They're sort of stuck there. But then that's a sign of death, isn't it, to be immovable. The body hasn't laid down yet, but you did. The nice step is a great freeing thing. Now I can see that everything I've lived through, everything in God's economy, if properly examined and used to help others, has value. Absolutely nothing is wasted. Like Emerson says, today, like all days, is a good day. If we but know what to do with it. If we know what to do with it. I don't know what to do with it. So, in the morning, you get on your knees. Hey, God, this is Alfred. Or Tom, it makes no difference. Say, let me know what you want me to do today. That way, I'm sure it's going to be a good day. And then go do it, regardless of what you think. You remember, Tom, you thought for 32 years you had injured a brother. You were wrong, Tom. You were wrong. It's that simple. Like the phoenix, out of the ashes of being wrong for 32 years, rises a whole new life of hope and joy, and the ability to pass that on to you, to take a second look at some of your guilts and some of your shames and find out how much righteousness has damaged you. Dave?
I share a little bit of my nine-step amends with you as best I see them. I had my list, and I talked a little bit about, you know, amends to myself. It's really to stay on the path. Probably one of the biggest ones on the list were my grandparents, who I lived with for 10 years through the end of my drinking and through a good bit of my sobriety until I got married and finished college and moved out of the house. My grandfather, I think I had mentioned last night, my grandfather didn't make it to high school, and he did his best that when my father had went off to Vietnam, my father asked my grandfather if anything were to happen to him, if my grandfather would see to it that I was taken care of. And the man who didn't make it to high school saw me through a PhD, gave me a place to live, and supported my education. The man loved me like a son. And through my alcoholism, I stole from him. My grandmother, a woman of great faith, I tested her to the point where she wasn't sure whether God heard her. She told me later that she had prayed towards the end of my drinking that I would die so it would be over. She loved me that much. She couldn't stand the suffering. They drug me out of jail, sat beside the bed and prayed with me. Countless times spent hard-earned money. Grandparents aren't wealthy people. They paid for a treatment center out of their pocket. got me out of countless scrapes. Thousands and thousands of dollars of money that they really didn't have to try to keep their grandsons from dying. How do you make amends for that? How do you go to somebody and say, I'm sorry. Sorry for breaking your heart. I'm sorry for taking your faith. I'm sorry for blowing your retirement. I'm sorry for taking your joy for 10 years. How do you do that? That's what I brought to the table June 23rd of 1990. Let me run you through some highlights of amends to my grandparents. And please don't think as I'm telling you these things this is about me or that I'm taking credit for them. Anything that I tell you about my 9-step amends and the things that have happened are a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and God. Less than a year sober, the college that I was on academic probation for inducted me into the National Engineering Honor Society, and I invited them to come down with me as I was inducted in the honor. Indicted. A Freudian slip there. Inducted in the Honor Society, and a month later they sat in the front row of my first anniversary with tears in their eyes. Maybe for the first time, starting to believe that there might be some hope for their grandson. That I had never had a year before. And they could see the change. I had went to them in the 9-step and, you know, I knew it wasn't about saying I'm sorry. I knew the word amend means to change. I had no idea how to set what was done right. I believe what the book said, that amends to some people can scarcely be made in a lifetime. In their case, that is true. I also had another grandmother and aunt on my father's side. Who I felt like I owed some amends to. I held both of their hands as they took their last breath and died while I was sober. That was my amends that I saw them through. I was there, through the good times and through the bad. They also got to see my first anniversary. My grandfather, who had held my hand, and the one whose heart I had broke, the one who had raised me as a son, held my hand and watched me die in the hospital. 4 years sober. Go back for a second. I had seen him cry twice before that night that he held my hand watching me die. Once when he buried each of his parents. That night I saw, when I asked him if I was going to die, I saw a tear run down his cheek and I knew the answer. And I didn't know how I would ever make up for that. 4 years sober. Little stone church in a little back room beside the altar. Trying to catch a glimpse of my wife coming down the aisle as I stand there. And I feel her hand on my shoulder. And I turn and I look. And my grandfather's standing there. And he's got a little tear running down his cheek. And he tells me how honored he is. How honored he is. That I chose him to be my best man at my wedding. There are moments like that that I'll carry with me till I'm no longer here. I might even carry those with me long past this earth, I don't know. But I know that's what amends is about. Because I can feel it in here. Last year I got a call from the hospital. From him at work. And we didn't know at the time, but his colon had exploded and he was dying. And I could hear in his voice that he was scared. Grandfather don't get scared. So I dropped what I had going on at work that day, that moment. I said, I'll be there in 15 minutes. And I went and I held his hand because he was afraid he was dying. And he was at the time. He didn't. But he was afraid, the way I was afraid that day. And I got to hold his hand and try to make it okay for him. My grandmother got to be in the room when my wife gave birth to my first child. Same woman who prayed beside my bed, begging God to please help me. Got to be part of seeing her first great-grandchild brought into this earth. She comes over every morning to take my son for a walk. Because they live next door to me. Because I told him part of my amends in sobriety was I said, I will see to it with everything that I have and all that I am that you all will never be left alone. That anything that you need that I can provide is yours. That I am with you until you're no longer here or I'm no longer here. My grandmother laughed it off. We've always taken care of you, Dave. How are you going to take care of us? Today it's not a laughing matter. If she was sitting here, she would tell you that she believes that and that she's seen it come to pass. And in her heart, she knows that as long as I'm capable, that I will do all in my power to see to it that they're taken care of. With God's help. These are the kind of things that I've got to see. My two little kids, they go out our front door and they make a right turn and they go about 100 feet to the porch of my grandparents' home. And they get to see them almost every day. And sometimes I wonder who really gets the benefit out of it all, you know? I mean, because we get help with the kids and they get their lives brightened up. But I tell you, to see them light up when those kids run in that door, I know it's God. And I know that wouldn't happen if it wasn't for you. My father, I'll talk about him for 5 minutes and I'll shut up. I told you when I did that fifth step that a lot of the burden of my father's death had been removed, and then I told you later on as I held my little girl in my arms that somehow I knew there was more to be done there, but I didn't know how to do it. A month after she was born, the phone rang. I had never heard from anybody that knew him or served with him for 30 years. And a month after my daughter's born, the phone starts ringing. There's a guy that served in Vietnam with him and said, hey, I don't know if you want to know anything about your father. And I know this might be a bad time to call because you've probably gotten on with your life. But for some reason, I just feel compelled to call you. You know what I say to him? I say to myself, not now. Too much is going on right now. This is what I'm saying on the inside. God, I can't walk through this right now. So I get the guy's number, and I promise I'll call him back. And I think I will call him back, just not now. And I hang up the phone. And a month later, the phone rings again. This time, it's not a guy that served in Vietnam with him. It's a guy who knew him in high school. 30 years, the phone hasn't rang. And the phone won't stop. And I tell him the same thing. Thank you very much. I got your number, and you know, I got this new baby. I'm finishing a PhD. It's crazy in my house. And I just can't deal with this right now, God. Finally, that all settles down about 6 months later. God keeps nudging me. I got this phone number. I knew I had to do it. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are certain things. When God knocks on your door, you know, it's not even good to tell him, hold on a minute, but you certainly can't shut the door. And I knew God had not. It was very clear. He made it very clear. So I try to call the first guy back when the guy served me, and I can't get a hold of him. Now I'm really upset. You know? I say, all right, well, hell with him. I'm going to find some stuff out. And I get and I write a little thing, and I post it on the website with the group that he had served with. It was about 3 years ago, a little more. Since then, I've talked to 50 men. At least. Stopped counting after a while, and I was told the same thing over and over again. The guy that I had grown up with, hearing about, this guy who was just too good to be true. And I was a little scared when I started his Vietnam stuff because I thought, man, my father was Special Forces. He was in Cambodia long before we were supposed to be there. The things he did, the way he changed. You know, he had four guys shot out from underneath of him and watched him die. He's the guy that wouldn't step down when they gave him the chance. You know, what if I find out some horrible, terrible, tragic things about my father that I don't want to know? But I owed it to him. I wanted to find out who he was, not who I thought he was, who was the man really. And as I talked with these guys, one after the other, one of them said, we're having a reunion. We want you to come. Will you get on a plane and fly down and talk with some of us? And I did. and I invited my mother to come along. And what I found out about, I found out about Alcoholics Anonymous in a whole different way and a whole different part of my life. Once again, I saw what you all taught me applied in a way that I wouldn't have believed it would work. And my mom had told me, she said, I've wanted you to do this from the time your father died. I wanted you to want to know who he was. But I couldn't force you to. It was something you had to come to on your own. And she didn't get there until the reunion was well underway, and I showed up by myself the first day. And I walked down into this room full of Vietnam vets, and they looked the part. And they didn't look like me, and I felt so different. I didn't feel like I was a part of it all. I felt like such an outsider. I felt like they were looking at me with contempt, like, who's this young punk walking into our group? And I walked out, and I went back up to my room, and I got on my knees, and I prayed, and I asked God to please help me. And I walked back down, and I walked up to a table full of men, and it seemed to me like they were glaring at me with contempt. And I stuck out my hand, and I said, my name is David Dawes, and my father served in Vietnam and was killed, and I'm here to try to find out all I can. I did what you all taught me. I reached out for help. And I watched the look on their faces change. And there was absolutely nothing those men couldn't do, even though they didn't know my father. There was absolutely nothing that they couldn't do to try to help me find somebody. And so I kind of paved the road for my mother, who came a couple days later, and by the time she got there, I knew exactly who everyone was. And I was able to make it easy for her. And I got to watch as she thanked one of the men who had got his body out from behind enemy lines. I got to watch the healing take place. They were in tears. I was in tears. She was in tears. These guys had carried the guilt to my father's death for 30 years. They blamed themselves for not getting him out of there alive. And, you know, what you all taught me. You show up, and what I thought was I would walk away from there, and maybe I would get some healing, maybe my mom would get some healing. But what I found out is that amends are not one-sided. That showing up there and having the courage, see, that it kind of occurred to me, like, who is this guy that does this? And even some of the men were like, wow, you came in here by yourself, not knowing anybody? You walked into the room and, you know, who are you? You must be somebody special. You've got courage like your father had. You're just like him. And I'm thinking, nah, that's the program to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's what does it, man. That's where the courage comes from, God. And I watched great healing take place there. And now when I think about my father, you know, as I was sitting there, and you know what I saw there? I saw what Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw what we see in Alcoholics Anonymous to a greater level. We talk about, you know, in the book, they use the analogy of being on a ship and how, when the ship goes down, whether you're in steerage or sitting at the captain's table, we're all in the same boat. And there's a common bond. And I saw that in them. It was even stronger than we see here. It was amazing. And when I walked away from there, I knew that my father did not go on that last mission because he didn't want to be with me. He went on that last mission because of the men he served with, because that's the kind of bond there was. Because he didn't want one of them to die in his place. He couldn't have lived with that guilt. And there was healing in a way that I've, thousands and thousands of dollars and countless hours of sitting with a psychotherapist. And it would have been so easy not to have to walk through that emotional pain. It was hard. And I cried a lot. You know, there's through that reunion and afterwards. And, you know, when I came back and I held my daughter and I held her tight, and I begged God never to let her have to go through what I just went through to learn who her father was. Let me stay and be part of her life. Please, God. Please. But you know what? I walked away from that knowing that I had done what I was supposed to do, knowing that I knew the man better, knowing that the amends were largely done, knowing that when I thought about him, I really felt like I knew him. And finding out that he wasn't all that different than me. A little bit younger, but not all that different than me. And so what the psychiatrist had told me one time about when you think about that, there may be some sadness, but that not that knife in your gut pain. That healing and that amends has done that. And once again, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and God has done for me that which I thought was impossible. And that's all I have on the ninth step. So I guess we're on for another break, huh? Thank you.